This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. The documentary Alice's Ordinary People will be shown on Thursday at the Kalamazoo Public Library. Coming up, we'll speak with the film's director, Craig Dudnick. But first, how does a family business get off the ground? Once it does, is it different from the large company down the street? How does a family business grow, and what happens when it's time to pass from one generation to another? Those are some of the questions that Laurel Ofstein tries to find the answers to. She is a professor of management in Western Michigan University's Haworth College of Business. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
How did you get interested in studying family businesses?
Well, my primary area of interest was entrepreneurship, and when I was doing my PhD at the University of Illinois Chicago, they asked me to teach an undergraduate class called Family Business Management. PhD students often are assigned classes to teach, so I was doing my duty in teaching and taking on this class. But after learning about the different content and the ways that family ownership and management of a business all interact, and having the guest speakers come to talk about their experience in their family businesses, I became hooked. It was so interesting to me. And the students who came from business families had such a deep connection to the content because they were living it. They'd grown up in business families. They had worked there during the summers. Their parents had told them stories about the previous generations of how the business worked. And so there was a real personal connection there to the students and then for me to the content.
Are there some characteristics that you find fairly consistently in a family business as opposed to other types of companies which may be in the same field and competing? But do the family businesses tend to follow certain rules or guidelines, if we might use that term?
A lot of family businesses put family first. So they might look for family employees to hire for different positions before looking outside. Family businesses usually have family active in management. Whether or not they're working at the business on a day-to-day basis, they're often the decision makers in terms of strategy. They may have family on the board of advisors or on a board of directors, and they usually put family first in terms of decisions about the business. And often their employees first as well. Even non-family employees become part of the family.
When people might think of a small business, perhaps a bakery comes to mind. We've got a few in Kalamazoo. But it's also some of these companies which start off rather small tend to grow. We've got Stryker here in this part of the woods, Kellogg, Meijer. Is it rare, though, for a family business to grow that much where it becomes this worldwide corporation in the case of something like Stryker?
Yes, very much so. A lot of times family businesses want to stay local. They're interested in staying in their own communities. And when those businesses grow, Stryker, for example, went international many times over. And so because they have that kind of an international presence, you need to have family members that are willing to go work in those places. Or you need to grow and be okay with hiring non-family managers, non-family professionals who can take on those challenges. Finding the skills for growing a business as large as Meijer or as large as Stryker and making that work is very difficult because sometimes the second generation or whatever the next generation is doesn't have those skills.
And is that one of the keys to perhaps growth is that recognizing that there may be a need to find people who have skills beyond what the family unit has in and of itself?
Yes, one of the things I talk most about in a family business class that I teach now is about professionalizing the business, the importance of establishing job responsibilities, job descriptions, the importance of creating an understanding of what the business needs to grow, creating the strategy first, and then coming back and seeing who the right people are to fill those roles. And when you have an objective way of measuring sort of where the business is going and how you're going to get there, you wouldn't, if you were thinking objectively, always hire family first for those positions.
because when you're making a business decision and thinking about what's best for the business, you want to consider all possibilities sometimes, correct?
Yeah, you should. And so family businesses don't always want to grow. They want it to be more family-centric. And so they may not make those decisions, and that's okay. You know, it's not every business's goal to be the next multi-million dollar business. Many people want to provide a good living for themselves and for their family members, and that's why they maintain the family business, and that's why they have the family business, because it supports their family and the lifestyle that that they've come to enjoy.
Why do you find students from family-run businesses often taking your class?
So I teach a family business management class at Western in the College of Business, and the students are so excited to meet other students that are part of a family business. It can feel very isolating sometimes because you look at other businesses that maybe are non-family business, and they're not having an argument in the middle of the day with their mom in the lunchroom or with their brother over a decision where, you know, things about, well, you always came in first in, you know, in sports and I was always second and now I'm trying to lead and you don't understand where I'm coming from. You don't think I can lead this because I wasn't ever first. All of these things from childhood come into play. And so having an understanding that that's normal in family business, that there are ways to set some boundaries around that, is so enlightening for these students. And usually they come away with a really strong understanding that they're not alone, that there are ways to professionalize the business.
Do they sometimes take your class seeking the answer to the question, should I be that next generation to run the family business?
Yes. And sometimes they come away with a much stronger feeling that I can do this. And sometimes they come away with the feeling that, wow, this is not for me. I just don't think that if this is how family businesses run, the successful ones versus the unsuccessful ones, I don't see my parent or my uncle or whoever they're working for being able to make these changes to make this a place that I'm willing to work long term.
What are some things that you advise students to do if they are on the fence and they're not sure? Yes, I, you know, think it seems like something I could do, but maybe there are other things I would rather do. If they're on the fence, what do you advise them?
First, I advise students to talk to their parents or whatever member of their family is leading the business. It's amazing how many times I ask students to interview a family business and they interview their parent because they've never talked to them in a formal way about the business, about where they see their child taking on, you know, what kind of role they see their child taking on after graduation. And sometimes the parent is ready to step back or has a plan in mind, and it surprises the student and they're excited about what that possibility looks like. In other cases, I also advise the students to encourage a frank conversation around job descriptions, around what kind of ownership plan might be in place in the future. Estate planning is very much tied up into this. It's hard for students or any child to ask their parents, hey, you know, what kind of planning have you done for, you know, when something happens to you? But many family business transitions happen suddenly based on some kind of a triggering event. The parent has a health event, like a heart attack, or someone dies in a major accident. It's very unfortunate, but we see it in even some of our businesses here in Kalamazoo, that a tragedy throws the next generation into the role of leading a family business, and they didn't know what their parents' wishes were.
Do you also advise students that there are some other things they might want to go out and explore, and that maybe this decision on taking over the family business should wait just a little bit?
Definitely. One of the strongest success factors for the next generation succeeding in a family business is outside work experience. We tell them, go get a job somewhere at a similar business, in the same industry maybe, in a similar field, and get experience that you can bring back into your family business. And make sure then that you want to be in this industry, that you want to be part of the family business. When students go into a family business because out of guilt, out of fear that they're missing an opportunity that won't be there in the future if they don't take it now, those aren't the true feelings of passion for the business, of feeling that you have a contribution to make that you would get from going and working somewhere else for a few years, learning the best practices of another business, what works and what doesn't, and also getting objective performance feedback. So getting a performance appraisal from someone who is not your parent or someone who's worked with your parent for the last 10 years and knows that someday you could be their boss. You know, that's a difficult situation to be in for someone who's been working at the company for a long time and is looking at someone in their 20s who may be their boss within the next 5 to 10 years.
Is it rare for a family business to keep going for generations? In other words, is it more likely that the parents may get the business started and then either their children or, if not them, the grandchildren decide, no, this isn't for me?
Yeah, actually, only about 30% of family businesses are successfully transferred to the second generation. Only about 12% make it to the third generation, and 4% to the fourth and beyond. So here in Michigan, we did some research and found that we're a little bit higher in West Michigan in terms of our family business success rates. We did a survey that included about 150 family businesses and found that about 15% of them were in the third generation and 11% were in the fourth, so way over that 4%. In many cases, we see that over the generations, the business is taken for granted by later generations. We say from shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves in three generations. It's something that's used a lot in family business to explain how the first generation, especially thinking historically to the businesses that are here in West Michigan, may have been started by a grandparent who came from another country and started their own business and grew it to be what their family could live on. But there were a lot of tough times, good times and bad times. And by the time that generation passed it on to maybe the parent generation, so the second generation, they led a pretty good lifestyle. They were able to grow the business. The business was up and running. It was doing well. And when they have children, the third generation, the grandchildren of the founder, they grow up in luxury. They oftentimes have everything they need. They don't have to work as hard. They don't remember the history from the grandparents and how they struggled. The parent might remember the early days of the business and how they couldn't, they didn't have everything they needed. The grandparent wasn't at their baseball games, didn't have the flexibility because there weren't the right people in place. But the grandchildren grow up and many times don't have that same work ethic and sometimes run the business into the ground.
Is the key for a family business going forward answering a couple of different questions here? One of those being, do the children have at least similar interests to the parents, maybe in the similar industries that they both find interesting? And then the second one being, do the children have the same interest as their parents in actually owning the business and running the business, which is a whole nother set of skills and a set of commitment? Are those two questions that you have to answer, and if you don't answer them both yes, then maybe this isn't going to work?
Definitely. Many children of family business owners saw their parents struggle, saw their parents not be able to take vacations because of the business, saw them argue with their siblings who maybe were also involved in the business, perhaps to the extent that parts of the family aren't even talking anymore. A lot of times those business complications get brought into the family. And so the next generation may not, even if they're interested in the industry, may not want that kind of lifestyle. They may choose to go work for someone else to be successful in a career that where they don't have those complications, where they don't have to face those challenges.
Laura Lofstein, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Laura Lofstein is a professor of management in Western Michigan University's Haworth College of Business. You can find a longer version of the interview with Laura Lofstein and a link to the Encore magazine article about her work at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.
Our people faced many hardships in our struggle for freedom and justice. I am writing to tell you what some ordinary people and I did to bring about change so that your generation might learn from what we experienced.
That is Chicago activist Alice Tregay reading from a letter to her children and grandchildren in the documentary Alice's Ordinary People. It will be shown on Thursday at the Kalamazoo Public Library. The film's director, Craig Dudnick, will also be on hand for discussion after it is shown. Craig Dudnick joins us. Thank you for being with us.
Oh, thank you, Gordon.
So first of all, what interested you in this film? What brought you to actually make this documentary?
Well, Alice approached me. She had seen, actually, her brother was Evanston's first black firefighter in 1950. And I had made a film about the African-American community in Evanston called Evanston's Living History. And Alice had pictures of her brother. So I used those, you know, pictures of him on the fire department. And then I didn't know who Alice was other than she had, you know, some role with, you know, the civil rights movement. Her brother had told me that. But I didn't know the depth of her involvement. And then Alice really liked the finished film that I had made about the African-American community in Evanston. And she asked if I could make a film about the movement, the Chicago Freedom Movement. And it was sort of a great challenge. You know, I said I would try to handle it. It's a much bigger project than the Evanston one. And so that got us started. And then about 2 years later, we had the film that you played, Alice's Ordinary People.
And give us kind of the quick synopsis there of the Chicago Freedom Movement and what Alice did as part of that.
Okay. Well, Alice really got pulled into the Freedom Movement. She was marching to desegregate the schools where her children were going, Chicago 1964. What had happened was they were running out of room in the Chicago schools, in the black community. There was plenty of room in the white schools, but in the African-American community. So what the superintendent, and his name was Willis, his answer was to make these additions. They were tin, sort of shed-type additions without heating or air conditioning. And this brought out hundreds of thousands of people in protest. And also they asked Dr. King if he would come to Chicago. And in 1966, this draws Dr. Martin Luther King to Chicago. And Alice and her husband took part in some of the terrible protests, the marches that Dr. King took part in Chicago. But it's after Dr. King's death that the civil rights movement becomes centered in Chicago. And that's when Alice had the idea that they needed to be involved in politics. So she taught a class as part of Operation Breadbasket called Political Education, How to Run a Political Campaign. Her first class had 25 people, but within the next few years, they had trained 5,000. And then Alice taught herself actually how to run campaigns. But at first, as her daughter told me, all the candidates lost, as she put it, because she said they were good people. But slowly they started to win, and the offices kept getting bigger, eventually leading to the election of our first African-American mayor, Alice's friend Harold Washington. And it's really the Washington victory that draws a young Barack Obama to Chicago for his own political education. So this is Alice is really the link that takes us from Dr. Martin Luther King to President Obama. She saw politics was going to be the future of the movement.
And yet, as you say, you, as someone in the Chicago area working on a documentary about her brother, didn't know a whole lot about her story. Is it something that kind of got lost a little bit in the history of the civil rights movement, and even in Chicago in particular?
Yes. I mean, I knew nothing. I didn't know her name, and I didn't know, you know, the role of, I mean, just the whole, how Breadbasket and how Alice had formulated politics, all of that story got lost. Suddenly, Barack Obama just seemed to appear. He just seemed on the scene, and you know, after the early 2000s. But no, this was a whole movement, you know, that had been built up. And Alice is the same age as Dr. King, and really brought to it a similar depth of a commitment. I remember talking to Alice about Dr. King, and she'd say, you know, he would make you feel as if you were the most important person there. And I asked her what would he have thought about all the roads and things named after him. And she said he never would have believed it. they were very low-key. You know, they really were interested in getting something done, and that was Alice. But this was a very important story, you know, that did somehow get missed and really had a big effect on our democracy.
I want to play a little clip from the film here. And this is pertaining exactly to President Obama's campaign for president.
I went to an alternative school, and I talked about Obama running. I asked them, would they help me? And I had about 15 of the students come out on the last day to register to vote to help.
Craig Dudnick, she was still very active then relation to the Obama campaign for president.
Yes. Didn't have quite the primary role that she had in earlier campaigns, but she let, you know, the groundwork for it. And, of course, people from Operation Push were going to the states, to Iowa and Michigan to work for him, and all the people in the movement were working for him.
Do you think that she recognized, perhaps, the way some other people didn't, that it was going to require working within the system, getting people elected, defending political allies when they face tough re-election battles, which you document as well in the film? Did she recognize that, maybe ahead of some other people, that that was going to be a key part of the civil rights movement and other efforts to make life better for people in Chicago?
Yes. It's pretty incredible that she sort of had this vision of building a political movement, building it within the system, that it could be done. I remember interviewing, you know, some of the men who had taken part of it, and they were in tears when they talked about Alice because a lot of them didn't think this could be done. But Alice brought a special spirit, you know, and we've seen this in the past. You know, these figures like Harriet Tubman, I mention her because it's that courage and that, you know, to throw themselves in, you know, against the odds. And, you know, as Harriet Tubman said, I'm either going to be free or I'm going to be dead. And, of course, you know, with a $40,000 bounty overhead, she goes and continually goes back down south bringing people, you know, to freedom. Well, Alice, it's that kind of courage. You know, she has a vision that they need to get people elected, that the African-American community is the most loyal to the daily machine. And for that loyalty, and they're also the biggest component in, you know, in that electorate, for that loyalty, they're getting basically nothing in return. And so in order to get services and get representation for their community, they're going to have to start to get people elected. But how do we do that in a system that's stacked against us? And they built it from the ground up. And that's, I think, the most important part, you know, that it's built from the ground up. And that's what Alice, and a lot of creativity. Another example of the creativity is for Harold Washington, when he was going to run for mayor, he was a congressman and he didn't want to give up that position so quickly. So he said, I will only run for mayor if you can get 100,000 new registered voters and raise $100,000. They raised the money. But to get the voters, Alice saw a bill in your state, in Detroit, called deputy registrars, where you could register people in public libraries, high schools, not just downtown, but in different places. And she gave this bill to her friend, Senator Brookins in Illinois. They got it passed, and it brought in 150,000 new voters. And they credit that bill with electing Harold Washington. So they were very creative in this process, with Alice at the head.
We just had an interview on this program recently about women in the civil rights movement who maybe didn't get their due.
Sure.
One of the things that we got into in that discussion is whether or not women maybe had some different roles. They were not, you know, preachers at the pulpit, and maybe they worked a little more behind the scenes. Is that part of what Alice did, that she often, you know, she didn't run for elected office herself, but she often, you know, would help people who were running and maybe, you know, did the activism and the grassroots work that paved the way for others?
You know, Alice got nothing, you know, for herself in terms of within the movement, she was well known. But outside of the movement, she wasn't. But that selfless quality, I think, was what was so inspiring about her. You know, it wasn't about her. It was about the movement. And Alice, you know, this is really something because Alice told me that she wanted to, because you mentioned the other women in the movement, to go to the White House. She told me she had been there with President Clinton and Carter. She had been to the White House before, but she wanted to go visit the White House while President Obama was there. So she had me write a letter, you know, to the White House. And in the letter I wrote, and Alice fits easily among this great group of women, Rosa Parks and Fannie Lou Hamer and Ella Baker. And, you know, and Alice said to her husband, "Oh, Jimmy, he's got me in some pretty good company." Well, sadly, Alice passed away 2 weeks later, so she didn't get to the, you know, to go to the White House. It was a sudden, you know, her death was sudden. But she thought, especially Fannie Lou Hamer in Mississippi, you know, was a great role model. You know, the activist in Mississippi who was sort of a sharecropper, I think one of 20 children who did so much for voter rights in Mississippi. So these women haven't gotten really the recognition, but they play a huge role. Huge role in the movement.
I want to play one more clip from your film, and this is Alice actually receiving an award, and at the same time, she is still talking about the work that has to be done.
I am still doing voter registration with the Citizen Action, and I guess I will do that until they put me in my grave, and I thank you very much.
And Craig Dudnick, she did continue work right up until the end of her life, correct?
Oh, yes, she did. You know, she's remarkable. It was February. She died in 2015, in April of 2015. In February 2015, I asked her to go to Ferguson, Missouri with me because, like, you know, so many of us, we didn't know the history of what they had done in Chicago, and I thought how it would, you know, be a great benefit to tell the young people there what they had already accomplished in Chicago. And, you know, it was very cold and without hesitation, you know, and Alice wasn't that well then, you know. She went to go to the public library and talk about the film in Ferguson, and then was very active in the presidential campaign. We had our first ever runoff between Chuy Garcia and Rahm Emanuel for the you know, position of mayor in Chicago. Alice wasn't happy with our current mayor, especially with the closing of 50 schools. So Alice worked very hard, and that was her last campaign. And, you know, I think that really was the one that was too much for her. But she worked right on up to the end. That was her life.
So I wonder, as we sit and talk on a Monday morning following a weekend of a lot of protests across the country, at airports from sea to shining sea, I guess you could say, regarding the Trump administration's ban on immigrants from certain countries, is there something of a lesson to be learned from Alice's activism, you know, not only perhaps in terms of demonstrations, but maybe some of the work that has to go on that doesn't get TV cameras lined up and that sort of thing?
I think that's a very good point. You know, the working to build within the system, there's a lot of room within the Democratic Party to, you know, because this is what Alice told the group in Ferguson, that you have to register everybody to vote, and you've got to field candidates, and you've got to make sure that everybody votes, and if the candidates aren't responsive, you have to pull those candidates. It takes a lot of work, but this is grassroots politics. And I think that grassroots politics is the intersection of the civil rights movement and politics. That's when it changes in Chicago. Remember, you know, President Obama worked at registering voters in Chicago as well, and was an organizer. So this grassroots part of it is very important, and that's this what they did so well in Chicago. And that if you do bring that discipline, you know, bring candidates out, make sure that you've got good candidates, and work very hard to register, vote, and do all the things that you need to do, people are going to start to get elected. And there's a lot of people out there, and they can have a lot of power in, you know, in moving the government to respond to the will of the people, which is what you really want to do.
All right. Craig Dudnick, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you, Gordon.
Craig Dudnick is the director of Alice's Ordinary People. He will be at the Kalamazoo Public Library on Thursday when the documentary is shown. The screening begins at 7 o'clock. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.